Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today is Marianne Williamson. She's a best-selling author and lecturer, and now a Democratic presidential candidate. Williamson's campaign is based on the same themes that have brought her acclaim and financial success for the past 30 years. She calls for a moral and spiritual awakening in this country, and for a politics based on love, not fear. That ethic guides her positions on the issues. For example, Williamson says her economic policy would be capitalism with a conscience, and on national security, she'd seek violence prevention, establishing a U.S. Department of Peacebuilding. Let's get your questions in for the candidate this morning. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. And in addition to listening today, you can watch our interview on Facebook Live. And Ms. Williamson, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Why do you think you would make a good president?
I believe we need a president to navigate the times in which we live from a more holistic, integrative perspective. I think our politics is stuck in a modality that is very 20th century. It focuses on externals. It focuses on symptoms, but not on cause. It waters the leaves of our democracy, but it doesn't water the roots. And the roots are inside us. Our political system doesn't register the most important forces that drive human behavior. And that has to do with what's going on inside people. When you look at something like terrorism, that was hatred externalized. When you look at something like what happened in Charlottesville, when you look even at something like what's happening down at the border, there is mean-spiritedness, racism, bigotry externalized. And a system that doesn't have any understanding of how those forces are activated, doesn't understand how to ameliorate them, doesn't know how to navigate them, doesn't know how to deal with them. All it knows how to do is to treat the consequences of the craziness that emerges because they're there. We need a president who understands the larger array of factors, not just external but also internal ones, that drive human behavior. Economic despair, for instance. I think the populist uprising on both the left and the right in 2016 emerged from a level of economic despair. Now, the Republicans were gobsmacked by Trump, and the Democrats were gobsmacked by Bernie, and both for the same reason. They didn't even factor in what people were going through, the anger that people were feeling, the despair and the chronic anxiety economically that people were feeling. And so I believe that the political path going forward, I think even in terms of defeating the president, a better version of same old, doesn't interrupt the trajectory that got us here, and I don't even think we'll defeat the president.
Well, and I've heard you talk about the same old isn't going to solve the problems, isn't going to achieve that deep level of understanding that you feel is necessary, and that you seem to be saying both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump tapped into. But I do need to ask you the experience question, Ms. Williamson, and I know you've been asked this a lot. Many Democrats would be the first to say that President Trump's lack of experience, lack of understanding how things work, how government and budgets and government agencies work has hurt the country. Why should they hand the keys over to you now with your similar lack of experience?
I don't think that the issue is that the president didn't know. It's that the president doesn't care. There's a big difference. The president doesn't seem to have a visceral taste for democracy. You don't have to be an experienced politician to know that there are three branches of government. You don't have to be an experienced politician to know some of the mechanical workings of politics. Experienced politicians, there's an illusion there that I think we should all bust. Experienced politicians took us into Iraq. Experienced politicians took us into Vietnam. Experienced politicians brought us to where we are. They brought us to where we are. So the idea that only those whose careers have been entrenched in the system that got us here are the only ones we should possibly consider qualified to lead us from here, I think is preposterous, actually, and I challenge that.
You ran once for Congress in California. I think it was 2014. You're aiming very high here, the highest office of the land, some would say the most powerful position in the world. Why not gain some experience, some understanding, Ms. Williamson, running again for Congress, maybe running for the state Senate, maybe running for mayor and member of the legislature?
Let's be very clear here. I've had a lot of experience, and there are other experiences. There are other kinds of qualifications. Anybody who thinks, for instance, that somebody who has served two terms in Congress, that gives them the elevated consciousness and the depth of gravitas necessary to lead this country, doesn't realize what congressmen do all day. What do you think congressmen do all day? It's almost a joke to me. So and it should be a joke to all of us. It is a meaningful experience to have been in Congress. It's a meaningful experience to have had a political experience. But there are all kinds of meaningful experiences. I have had 30 years of experience in working very up close and personal with people seeking to navigate the consequences of all the damage that has been done by an irresponsible political system. So America should be looking, it would seem to me, for people whose experience has as much to do with navigating these times as with replicating old times. And that means transforming these times. I have worked with people in moving from trauma to transformation. And I know that means that you have to do more than just change things on the outside. We need more. We need, as much as we need a political mechanic right now, we need a political visionary. FDR said that the greatest part, the most important part of the presidency is moral leadership. You can have the best car mechanic in the world, but that car mechanic doesn't necessarily know what road is the best one to take to San Antonio. And that's what I offer. I offer an understanding of the moral, spiritual, emotional, and psychological issues that prevail within the life of a nation, just as they prevail within the life of an individual, and that must be addressed if America is to do more than just defeat Donald Trump. The task is much bigger than that. We need to do more than just not go over the cliff. We need to get out of the vicinity of the cliff. We need to totally interrupt a trajectory that got us here. And those whose careers are based on maintaining that trajectory don't necessarily have even the vision. And these, by the way, this is not personal. I mean, really good people are running for president. I'm not running against anyone. I'm running with a lot of really good people. There's nothing personal to this. But this idea, it's the system which would have us believe that only their club, it's just a replication. You know, the political establishment and a lot of the media establishment fulfill the same aristocratic archetype that's at work everywhere else in America. It's the idea of a small club who seem to think they're entitled, who seem to think they're the ones who know, and they're the only ones worthy of our trust going forward. This is how we work economically, and where has it gotten us? This is how we've worked in terms of national defense, and where has it gotten us? This is how we work in terms of politics, and where has it gotten us?
Well, let's talk about your vision. And as you said, you want to present a broad vision for the country. Let's get into some of those policies, Ms. Williamson. Economic policy, as I mentioned, you said your approach toward the economy would be, quote, capitalism with a conscience. Give us some specific examples, please, of what that means.
When I was growing up, the social agreement in this country was that the corporation had a responsibility that was a moral responsibility and an ethical responsibility. It wasn't just fiduciary responsibility to stockholders. It was a moral and ethical responsibility to the workers, to the environment, to the community. You didn't just let somebody work for you for decades and then just like drop them and don't worry about whether or not they're going to be able to retire with dignity because, hey, you can get a younger person to come in and work part-time without benefits. When I was growing up, there was an understanding in the ethers that that would have been horrific behavior. Starting in the 80s, as we know, this entire society bought into, because unfortunately our government became an advocate for this economic system, which then hijacked our entire value system, which is basically a product, as we know, of trickle-down economics. The idea that all that a corporation should have to worry about is fiduciary responsibility to its stockholders without any sense of moral or ethical responsibility to people or planet.
So get it's, specific if you could,
I'll
Ms.
be
Williamson,
very specific.
What your plan would specifically
okay.
include.
Well, first thing I would do is repeal that horrific 2017 tax cut, which is just a complete giveaway, is a complete example of what happens in an aristocratic system where government is doing more to advocate for the economic good of a small group of people at the expense of everybody else in the society and the planet on which we live. I would repeal that 2017 tax cut, although I would put back in the middle class tax cuts. I don't know why they weren't there already. These corporate subsidies are ridiculous. Why are we subsidizing to billions and billions of dollars, $26 billion to the fossil fuel industry last year alone? Why are we subsidizing the fossil fuel industry? Why are we subsidizing agribusiness? Why are we subsidizing big pharma?
Getting rid of corporate subsidies, getting rid of the tax cut, but then putting the middle class tax cut
absolutely,
back in.
Absolutely.
I also saw on your platform, and again, sticking with this economic theme, immediate cash relief with a universal basic income of $1,000 a month per American adult.
No, that's not correct? I think
No universal basic income.
I did not say that either.
Okay.
Hold on a moment. We have an economic tsunami approaching with automation. I think we're going to need a mix of universal basic income and a federal jobs guarantee. But I think once we have a Green New Deal, what I want is a massive and immediate infusion of economic hope and opportunity into the hands of the American people. It's all of one piece. First, an immediate Medicare for all type of system. None of this. This is how Democrats talk. I think we should work towards that. That's a way of saying I'm going to say what I think you need me to say to get elected. I'm going to work towards that. It's like saying I'm going to have a commission. It's ridiculous. The American people need to wake to the game here. No, I mean an immediate universal health care, raise the minimum wage, cancel or renegotiate all of those college loans and make college free. And do these things quickly. FDR did them quickly. We can do them quickly. Now, in addition to that, when you have a Green New Deal type of situation, so you have massive infrastructure repair, and with that, massive job creation. So once you know what kind of job creation...
I'm so sorry. You've been on the campaign trail. I heard you were campaigning for 12 hours yesterday, so I understand you're a little hoarse.
Thank you.
Take the time once to have a sip of tea if you need it.
Thank you. Once you know what kinds of numbers you have for a massive job creation due to that, then you know how much we will need to augment that with universal basic income. That's why I'm not willing to say, well, $1,000. It might be $1,000. It might be less than $1,000, because once you mix that with federal job guarantee.
So you're starting with some of these efforts that you think will produce job creation, Green New Deal, Medicare for all, canceling college loans and so forth. And then you're saying after that, maybe universal basic income? Is that what you're saying? I'm just trying to get some clarity.
Well, I can walk and chew gum at the same time, and I think the U.S. government can do that. I think more important than our knowing what we're going to do on Monday versus what we're going to do on Thursday is recognizing that we need a massive change in attitude and consciousness about where money comes from. I don't believe money comes from giving it to a small group of people who act like our economic overlords who are going to drop the crumbs from the table. That's aristocracy. I'm going to get back to economic democracy. And I base everything on the basic philosophical foundations of this country. All men are created equal, and God gave all men inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I believe that there is inside every human being unlimited God-given potential. My 35-year career, thank you, my experience, has shown me that within each and every person, there is so much untapped, unmined gold, particularly, by the way, in every kindergarten in America.
And we should definitely talk about education.
Well, it's more than education. It's the realization of the incredible potential within the brain, particularly of the small child. I want to unleash the dreams of the American people, uncap their dreams, unleash the spirit. As soon as you make it easier for people to get out of the stranglehold of economic despair and anxiety, what will happen if I get sick? What will happen if my kids get sick? How am I going to pay for my kids to college? Let people show up in life. That's where your money comes from. So I'm talking about that which will unleash our economic good. So you cannot separate that from economic policy, because that's what our economic policy should be based on.
I want to remind our listeners that they can join us, and then we'll talk a lot more about your policies, Ms. Williamson. Our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest today is Marianne Williamson. She's a Democratic presidential candidate, best-selling author and speaker. Her books include A Year of Miracles and The Gift of Change. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Jenny sent us an email from Manchester. Jenny says, some of the best people I've ever met live in Los Angeles, where I lived for 14 years. You have expressed that you feel drawn to and centered in L.A. Please explain, Jenny says, to northern New Englanders who associate the city exclusively with showbiz, why you chose to live there for so long. Jenny, thank you very much for the email.
I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. I have lived most of my adult life in Los Angeles and New York and Michigan. I raised my daughter in Michigan. I love Los Angeles. I love Michigan. I love Texas. I love New York. I'm not speaking to the New Englander or the Texan or the Southwesterner. I'm speaking to the American in all of us. When I lived in Texas for all those years, I knew a lot of people in the oil industry because that's where they are. When I lived in Michigan, I knew a whole lot of people in the automobile industry because that's where they are. When I lived in Los Angeles, I knew a lot of people in the entertainment industry because that's where they are. Some of the most creative people in this country and even in this world live there. Let's not kid ourselves. When it comes to political issues, there are movies that have had more bravery and more fierce truth-telling and more honesty about many of the political issues in our lives than politicians have had. So this idea that this is part of the illusion of that there are only superficial people in L.A., that's pretty silly.
Well, thank you for the email, Jenny. And getting back to some of your economic policies, I just want to be clear and specific, Ms. Williamson. You talked, for example, about free college. Can you be more specific? Is it free all kinds of college for everyone, or is it free sort of public universities?
Yes.
And community college.
Yes, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
And free for everyone, no income eligibility. If I'm rich, I can still get free college?
Well, that's a pretty interesting question, and there's a lot to think about there. But I think that basically, I think it should just be available for people. I think that this is the point. America is better off when people produce. America is better off when people are free to create. America is better off. There is an investment. This is how I feel about the young people of America. And this is what the young people of America will feel when I'm president. I'm going to do everything possible. And by the way, I'm a mother. Are you a mother?
Mother of two boys.
Okay, so you know what I mean. I'm going to do everything. I want to look at every child the way I look at my daughter. I'm going to do everything possible to create the conditions for you to be everything that you can be. I want to remove all material shackles that would keep you from being able to actualize your potential. In response for that, in return for that, I want you to go out there and be everything that you can be. I want you to be the best woman or the best man, the best mother, father, employer, employee, friend, child, creator, citizen. This society is going to invest in you. This society is going to support you in thriving. Right now, our government almost acts punitively towards people. Government should be helping people thrive. That's why it's there.
Coming up, I want to ask you a little bit more about Medicare for All. That's definitely been an issue in this campaign. Also, we'll talk about education, including one of your proposals to establish a cabinet-level Department of Childhood and Youth. And we'll keep taking your emails and calls. Thank you for that one, Jenny. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And in addition to listening to our program today, you can watch us on Facebook Live. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The New Hampshire Supreme Court has said the state must provide an adequate education to every child. What exactly that means is up for debate.
You're confusing what the definition of an adequate education is and what school districts are actually spending for bells and whistles.
People are really at the end of a road here that I think needs a change.
I'm Sarah Gibson. Listen for Adequate, a new series about how the state decides the value of public education. Thursdays on Morning Edition, only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, another Democratic presidential candidate is here. We're sitting down with best-selling author and lecturer Marianne Williamson. Some of her books include, back in 1997, The Healing of America, and her new book is called A Politics of Love, a handbook for a new American revolution. We're hearing about her ideas on the economy and health care and child welfare, and we're hearing from you. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And again, in addition to listening today, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Ms. Williamson, a couple more specifics before we go back to our listeners. You mentioned that you were a big supporter of Medicare for All. One of the big critiques, as I'm sure you know, is that this would be extremely expensive. How would you pay for it?
First of all, once you repeal the 2017 tax cut, you get rid of many of these corporate subsidies, then you already begin to have more money. Medicare for All, there are many things we could do, such as Bernie talks about when he talks about half a penny that would be part of our stock every time somebody makes a stock purchase. There are certain ways that we could do that. However, this is what we need to do in terms of changing our thinking. As soon as you have Medicare for All, every American, when you look at how much of the average person's budget goes into health care, okay, then you look at how much money is then available to people because they do not have to pay for health care. That is that much more that they spend. That is that much more that they can spend on their own self-actualization. That then increases your consumer base. That then creates jobs. And that then increases our tax revenue. So to me, by having a Medicare for All type of system, we are actually ultimately putting more money into our economy, and that then reduces the deficit.
Because people are freed from their healthcare concerns that keep them from working? Is that what you're saying?
And keeps them from spending.
I just want to ask you about the cost issue again. Would there be, in your perfect world, any sort of skin in the game from the consumer, or could people just go to the doctor anytime, anywhere, and incur no cost?
Well, ultimately, yes, ultimately, I would like that. I would like people to just go and not have to worry about it. Right now, what I think we should have is you keep the Obama exchanges and you augment that with the public option. And with that public option, yes, there could be some small payment, at least at first. And then I think we'd all move there. And I also, in time, and I also think that people should be able to keep their private insurance if they want it, if they like it, or if they want to augment with that. But what I would like ultimately is for this simply not to be an aspect of the anxiety for the American. It's not for the British person. It's not for other people in the world in almost every advanced society. But more than that, I want to say, there are so many things about my policies which will enable us to live healthier lives. We have a healthcare system. Right now, even you and me are having this conversation. We're having this conversation about how we're going to pay for healthcare. This is an example of what's wrong with our political system in treating just the symptom. Our healthcare system is very good at helping people once they get sick. And then we're talking about how you're going to pay for that. It's not really a healthcare system. It's a sickness care system. We need to be thinking, just like we not just preparing for war, we need to wage peace. We need to think not just about sickness care. We need to think about all the things that we need to do to make the average American's life healthier.
And some of that is included in Obamacare, right? Preventative visits and more of an emphasis on wellness.
But not.
Not
really.
Enough, you're saying.
No, not at all, because nothing that challenges the corporate structure. Nothing that says, hey, agribusiness. Nothing that says, hey, fossil fuel companies. Nothing that says, hey, the toxins, the carcinogens, the various things that we do, not only in terms of the poisons in our food and the poisons in our atmosphere and the poisons in our Earth, but even taking into account all the ways that the economic anxiety and other forms of anxiety that are promulgated by a corrupt political system create so much stress, and stress is part of what makes people so sick. Our diet, our lifestyles are not aligned with our biology and our genes. So we need to have a holistic vision, not just of how to treat sickness, but how to help the average American be healthier.
Well, and that gets into some of your other policies on food, on climate change, and so forth.
You can't see these things. Right now, we just treat them as external symptoms and are not recognizing the deeper underlying causes. And if you go into the deeper underlying causes, then you have to go even to a deeper layer of the fact that the even deeper cause of many of these of these problems are the spiritual malfunction of the fact that our government does so much more to advocate for corporate profits, short-term corporate profits, than for the health and well-being of people and planet.
One more quick question, very specifically on Medicare for All, and then I do want to get to climate and education. I know that's super important for you. Also immigration, Ms. Williamson, because you've had a lot to say on that, and that's definitely been the news. But in most developed countries that have a Medicare for All type system, universal health care, people do have some out-of-pocket costs. The concern is that if you don't have a little bit of skin in the game, there won't be enough money to pay for all the health care that people seek.
And it might be when I have read so many different ways of approaching this. I have read ways of approaching this that say that that's necessary. I have seen ways of approaching it that say that that is not necessary, the American people tend to forget we're the richest country in the world. You know, we had a 2017 tax cut, and we didn't spend a whole lot of time on how you're going to pay for it. We invaded a country in a $2 trillion war, a country that didn't even have anything to do with 9/11 and had no al-Qaeda. And we didn't spend a lot of time on how are you going to pay for it. This how are you going to pay for it thing is part of the propaganda that really comes from a segment of society, originally comes from a segment of society that just wants to make sure that a small group of people get most of the money.
Well, so let's talk about some of those wars then and turn to national security. The president, as you know, of course, is commander-in-chief of the armed forces. You've said, if I'm elected president, a far more sophisticated, redesigned partnership between the Defense Department and the State Department would put our need to wage peace on equal part with our need to prepare for any necessary war. Two questions out of that, please. What does waging peace mean?
Four main factors are involved in peace creation. They won't shock anyone. These are factors which, when they are present, statistically increase peace and decrease violence. Number one, expanding economic opportunities for women. Number two, expanding educational opportunities for children. Number three, reducing violence against women. And number four, diminishing unnecessary human suffering wherever possible. We should see large groups of desperate people as a national security risk. Desperate people are more vulnerable to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces. This is true in a corner of an American city in relation to gangs. It's true in relation to two corners of the world where people have become then more vulnerable to terrorist organizations. It was at the root of the emergence of Hitler, and it's even true in relation to vulnerability to the lies of an authoritarian demagogue here in the United States.
So peace waging means what, Ms. Williamson?
Peace waging means an active, proactive, just as I described, those were very practical things we need to do that have to do with activities that prevent violence and actually increase the experience of people, which is more peaceful in the world. Now, we do the things that I just mentioned. We do them through the U.S. Institute of Peace. We do them through certain programs in the State Department, and we do them here in the United States through certain programs. But when you compare the amount of resources that we put into genuine peace creation in our schools, for instance, in the United States, restorative justice, conflict resolution, wraparound services, anti-bullying, even mindfulness in the schools, we know what actually creates greater peace. And we have people who are technicians, practitioners, are doing these things internationally, humanitarian work, as well as domestically. But we resource them like they're a little piece of parsley on the plate versus the huge filet of stake that we give to military spending. Now, this is not the military's fault. I'm not critiquing the U.S. military here. These are political decisions.
Sure, the military is doing its job that it's told
well,
to do.
Not only that, but a lot of the equipment that they get, they didn't even ask for. The U.S. Air Force, for instance, has bought 100 airplanes called the B-21 Raider. The B-21 Raider costs $550 million each, and each one carries both conventional and nuclear bombs. Now, you drop five of those, it's over for human civilization as we know it. You drop 10 of those, it's over for humanity on this planet for 200,000-300,000 years. That has nothing to do with our national security. That has to do with profits for defense contractors and the nuclear industry. And any thinking person knows it, but no traditional politician will discuss it. That's why I'm running for president.
So when you say waging peace, talking about, you know, economic development and so forth, just two quickie questions on that, if I could. One counterargument that comes up with that is, why should we give money and resources to people who, quote unquote, hate us in some of these areas of the world where it's sort of death to America? I wonder how you sort of break through that, Ms. Williamson.
Well, I think not so. You know, first of all, in terms
how do you wage peace with those countries in that sort of diplomatic and economic way?
No country is a monolith. And I think we have two categories of a problem with what you're just saying. There are some people who really hate us. But we have an even bigger problem than the people who hate us. And that's the people who just don't like us anymore. They don't necessarily hate us. But you know what? They used to like us. Because we used to display moral leadership throughout the world.
Can you give some examples?
I'll give you a lot of examples. I think that before 9/11, if we had spent the last decades before 9/11, when I was growing up, when all of us were growing up, we were taught to believe, because it actually, to some extent, was true, that the United States was a force of moral good in the world, that the United States really did lead with our democratic and humanitarian values, that when politicians said that we acted around the world in ways that actually served America's vital interests, we thought they meant democracy. We didn't know they meant Exxon. We didn't know they meant huge multinational American corporate interests. Too many people in the world, even the Dalai Lama himself told me this, that the people of the world do not see the United States as a great champion of democracy around the world.
Well, that started happening around Vietnam, though, right? I mean, that's the era that I grew up in, and
exactly
I don't know if a lot of people held that view that you hold, Ms. Williamson, around the world because of Vietnam.
Well, that's kind of my point. That's exactly my point, but I'm 66 years old, so I remember that transition.
Sure.
So when fewer people in the world started seeing the American flag decal around schools and roads and genuinely democratic institutions, they no longer felt morally and spiritually and emotionally and psychologically compelled by any attraction to the United States. And in their desperation, I believe, not just I believe, the statistics show this, were more vulnerable to the machinations of genuinely psychotic forces. So when America stands behind our values, we always do better. We do better economically. We do better in terms of our national security. That we love one another. It's not just a prescription for some philosophical ultimate good. It is a prescription for a way of living in the world that leads to peace and leads to prosperity.
So you said you'd, again, put waging peace on equal part with our need to prepare for any necessary war. Again, using your words there, what kind of war, Ms. Williamson, would be necessary, quote unquote?
I think World War II was a righteous war. I mean, if I'd been FDR, of course, I would have not, some people wouldn't say, of course, I would have joined in that. I think going into Afghanistan after 9/11 had a validity to it.
Oh, I'm, really? I'm That's not, interesting, because that was a big
pacifist.
Debate.
Yes.
A lot of people, the peace groups in this state said, don't start a whole war. Go in sort of strategically and
that's
take out.
Word. Well, that's all I'm saying. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. We use the word war. Military action, let's
gotcha.
Say. I'm not a pacifist. I'm not saying that military action is never valid or legitimate. And so actually, I would agree with what you just said.
Let's take some more questions and comments from our listeners. And again, our number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation with Democratic presidential candidate and bestselling author Marianne Williamson is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And here's an email from Grace who says, who would you appoint to your cabinet and to key leadership positions such as Supreme Court Justice, Energy, Treasury, National Security, Foreign Relations, Land Management, Natural Resources? why would you choose these individuals? Grace, thank you. I mean, obviously, you're not going to give us a list of 10 names, but I think she's trying to get at what types of people would you bring in?
Of course. There are a couple of people on my wish list. I have a great person on my wish list for Secretary of State, but I don't want to say his name because he might not want to be associated with me. But let's start there. Let's say Secretary of State. It's worth noting that the first Secretary of State in this current administration was the ex-CEO of Exxon. He wasn't a great humanitarian or diplomat, ex-CEO of Exxon. That pretty much tells you everything. We have a State Department now that works more as an advocate for American corporate interests, i.e. our willingness to go along with that war in Saudi Arabia, that genocidal war in Saudi Arabia, for the sake of $100 billion in an arms sale. So that would not happen in a Williamson administration. You have the greatest humanitarian, greatest diplomat as your Secretary of State. In terms of EPA, immediately, out with the chemical company executives, out with the oil company executives, apologists for the fossil fuel companies no longer working at the EPA. Instead, you have a world-class environmentalist heading the EPA, and you have the EPA becomes a magnet for the most excellent scientists, environmental scientists, sustainability experts, etc. In terms of our economic councils, we don't need a bunch of economists who are promulgating the system that we have now. We need more people on our economic councils who are transitioning to a time where there's a completely and radically different view of where money comes from. And that is the unleashing of the American, and particularly a concentration, including a massive realignment of investment in the direction of children 10 years old and younger. I want child psychologists. I want people who understand early childhood. I want elementary school teachers to come in and be part of a conversation about how we increase the economy. No more Goldman Sachs people, with all due respect. My economic councils will not be run by people who come from Wall Street.
But no economists, or economists combined
with
teachers?
There's a whole new breed of economists. You know, there's a whole new breed of economists. There are very enlightened economists. There are very enlightened political experts. I don't mean to say there are no great political experts in Washington. I'm not saying that, because there are. But still, it is run, even economically and even unfortunately under Democratic presidents, in a way that serves to extend the system as it is. When people said in 2016, even by voting for Trump, unfortunately, we want change because we know the system is rigged, they were correct in that. They got a con artist rather than a positive change agent. But the basic instinct that this is wrong, this is unfair, what's happening, and we want to change, that was a valid sentiment 2 years ago. And I believe it is not only still a valid sentiment, but it is still a valid and active desire.
Well, that gets us into something that you say is a key, key part of your campaign, as you call it, the paramount issue, and that's the influence of money on politics. You just said the system is rigged, and that's why people were so excited about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, as you've said. How would you approach this issue of campaign finance, Ms. Williamson? Because, as you know, people have made attempts to fix the system before, and they haven't really worked out. There's more money in the system than ever.
One of the saddest things, of course, about the victory of Donald Trump in the last presidential election is that he was able to put conservatives on the Supreme Court and might even have more opportunity to do that. Not just conservatives, by the way. I want to make this clear. The high-minded conservative is not the enemy of democracy. The authoritarian corporatist is the enemy of democracy, and there's a big difference there. So we will not be able to overturn Citizens United anytime soon. I think we all understand that. We can know what our ultimate goal is, which is, for me, a constitutional amendment that would establish public funding for federal campaigns. In the meantime, there are various state efforts. New Hampshire Rebellion in New Hampshire and in other states. Maine, there are a lot of states that are coming up, you know, laboratories of reform, as Alexander Hamilton said. A lot of states are now coming up with their own efforts and their own projects with which to counter dark money.
I've got one more question for you about campaign finance after a short break, Ms. Williamson. And then let's turn to some of the politics of this primary, those upcoming debates that I know you want to participate in, and we'll keep taking your questions. Grace, thank you for that email. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477.
I'm Jason Moon, host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR. Join me for a live show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on Tuesday, May 14th. I'll speak about how we produced Bear Brook, the controversial science that helped crack open the case, and how that science is changing criminal investigations all across the country. Get your tickets now at thewilbur.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Friday on our show, our presidential primary coverage continues with former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who's just announced a Republican primary challenge against President Trump. That's Friday on The Exchange. Be sure to join us for that. This hour, we're sitting down with Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. She's a best-selling author and well-known speaker. And we're taking your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And one more question for you, Ms. Williamson, about campaign finance. And then I do want to go back to our listeners. We've got a lot of people who want to jump in. There's a flip argument to the argument that you've made and others have made that there's too much money in the system and so forth. Some people say, hey, if you clamp down on donations, only super wealthy people will be able to run for president like President Trump. So what do you think, Ms. Williamson? Would certain voices be drowned out if money were limited?
Money shouldn't be limited. Money should be removed from the system entirely.
Removed from the system entirely?
Yeah, that's what public funding of federal campaigns should be. I mean, I'm a candidate myself. This is absurd. You know, I raised $1.5 million so far, which it's almost funny to me. It makes you laugh because in the world of normal people, where I come from, $1.5 million is a lot of money. But they talk about that like, oh, compared to, you know, because everybody else has so many millions, it's just this money game. I think that's terrible. That's terrible for democracy. And the fact that I was able to raise $1.5 million, which, like I said, to me is a lot of money.
Sounds like a lot.
It comes from the fact that I have a platform based on a 35-year career. So people know my work. But how many geniuses are out there? How many brilliant people whose voices should not only be heard, but perhaps should be leading this country? They are college professors. They are whatever they are, but they are in professions that do not necessarily produce a lot of money. That doesn't mean that those professions don't produce good. Doesn't mean that those professions don't produce power. Doesn't mean that those professions don't produce creativity. And they're left out completely. Where are they supposed to look for an audience? Well, they're not in the system. They're not in the club. And then if they're not either business people or someone like myself who has a career as a writer, look what America is denying ourselves. We are denying ourselves some of the best minds, some of the best minds and the best thinkers in this country, the people who should be the most in the game at this time. Can't even think about something like running for president.
Because they can't afford it.
Because they can't. How would they ever begin? That's how wrong this is, and this is what we're doing to ourselves.
So we have public financing of elections, as I'm sure you know, but last cycle or two, at least, candidates have decided it's not enough money.
It's not enough to really fundamentally change the system. That's why we need a constitutional amendment.
So here's my question. So even if you say nobody can take any money at all except for this public financing, you're still going to have groups that will spend money to say, you know, support Marianne Williamson because she, you know, favors such and such a position. Do you see what I'm saying? You can't clamp down on the free speech of these groups that want to speak in favor of you or anybody else.
So, nor should you. I mean, the regulations would have to occur. But right now, since Citizens United, corporations can spend an unlimited amount of money. And there is no way that, to me, that is a free speech issue. That is a corporatist issue. That is an aristocratic issue. And it's the way the system protects itself.
Well, we've done whole hours on that topic. I'll set it aside for the moment, Ms. Williamson. Let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump in. And David's calling from Michigan. Hi, David. You must be listening online or on Facebook Live. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, David.
Marianne, I'm curious about your relationship that you see with Congress. It seems to me like in a lot of ways that senators have more control than the president does. Could you describe how you would work with Congress a bit?
Thanks, David, for the call.
Well, senators don't have more power, but Congress is a co-equal branch of government. So right now, you have the House in the hands of the Democrats, but you have the Senate in the House of the Republicans. It's not just the way the Constitution is laid out. It's also the ethics of people. When Mitch McConnell said when Obama was president that their main goal was to make him a one-term president. It was horrifying in terms of the ethics that should be present in politics, but also his overreach even constitutionally when he denied contrary to what the Constitution says, when he denied Obama the opportunity to put forth a Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland. So, really, David, what we need is new. The issue is not the Constitution. The Constitution is fine on this. The Senate does not have more power. The power lies in people, and people need to vote. Whether we're talking about the Russians or we're talking about Mitch McConnell or we're talking about money, we're talking about anything, there is only one real antidote to anti-democratic forces, and that is the will of the people exerted at the polls. More people, if you want this country to change, it ultimately does not have to do with President, Congress, House, or the Russians. It has to do with each and every one of us rising up, making sure we become a wave of massive protest and massive expression of our will and our desires at the polls.
Well, and Ms. Williamson, I think we have a lot of people watching on Facebook Live because I got another call from out of state. This is Amy in Arizona. Hi, Amy. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much
for
taking my call. Marianne, I wanted to ask you about transformation of politics. That seems to be a pretty important point for you. Why start as a Democratic candidate? Why not run as third party, independent, or even a Green candidate to really prove the power of the system just isn't working politically for us?
Amy, thank you for the question.
The Constitution does not mention political parties, and George Washington warned us about them in his farewell address. When I ran for Congress a few years ago, I did run as an independent. I was aware that abolition came from the Abolitionist Party, women's suffrage came from the Women's Party, Social Security came from the Socialist Party. So historically, third-party voices have been very important in America. However, that was then, and this is now. We have Donald Trump as president. So I see all party issues right now as broken legs and broken arms. I see the Trump presidency as a bullet near the heart. This is not a moment to play around. This is not a moment to, I would not do anything to risk taking even 10 votes away from the Democratic candidate in 2020. This is a moment when the primary goal has got to be, I believe, removing that man from office.
Well, Amy, thank you for the call. And to that point, Ms. Williamson, I think you were supportive of Bernie Sanders
yes.
last time around. Why not just go with him this time around?
I love Bernie Sanders. I think I was a passionate supporter of Bernie and then pivoted to Hillary when the primaries were over. Bernie feels moved to run, and obviously, therefore, he should. I feel moved to run as well. I'm talking about a massive realignment of investment in the direction of children 10 years old and younger. I'm talking about a U.S. cabinet-level Department of Peace. I'm talking about reparations for slavery. I'm talking about waging peace and U.S. Department of Peace creation and peace building. It's not that I disagree on Bernie very much. It's that I have a conversation that goes beyond where I feel he is taking us. So I'm a big fan of Bernie. That doesn't mean that I should step aside and not express what I would do because he's expressing what he would do.
Speaking of reparations, now tell me if I've got this right. You proposed $100 billion to African Americans in reparations for slavery, with $10 billion to be distributed annually over a decade for economic and education projects. Do I have that right, Ms. Williamson?
No, actually, I've landed at $200 to $500 billion.
Okay, so it's gone up since then.
Yes.
How would that be distributed? Are you giving cash to specific people, descendants of slaves, or are you picking and choosing projects that are somehow deemed worthy?
There should be a reparations council, a kind of board of trustees made up of many of the great scholars that have been working on this issue for years. Sandy Darity at Duke University, Ta-Nehisi Coates. There are many black leaders in academia, in politics, in culture, etc., who have done work on this. And I believe there should be, let's say, 30 people on this council, for instance, the money should be given specifically for the purposes and to be dispersed for the purposes of economic and educational renewal, and the money to be dispersed over a period of about 20 years.
So it wouldn't be your decision what's worthy and what isn't. It would be a council of people.
when you're handing over that kind of money, you certainly have a right to have a say. But no, if I owe you money, I don't get to tell you how to spend it. So the descendants of slaves, American descendants of slaves, should be making that decision.
Well, and I've heard you give the example of President Reagan in 1988 signing the Civil Liberties Act to compensate more than 100,000 people of Japanese descent who were incarcerated in those internment camps of World War II. I have to say, when I read about that and when I read about your proposal, setting aside whether it's a good idea or not, I'm not going to go there, but what about Native Americans? They were almost wiped out by white settlers. Should they get reparations?
Well, the conversation about reparations around Native Americans is simply a different conversation. It starts with the fact that so many treaties were unfairly negotiated. And even those that were semi-fairly negotiated, in so many ways, the United States has not lived up. For instance, I think we should give back the Black Hills of South Dakota to the Sioux. We signed the treaty in 1863 or whatever it was in the 1860s, and they should be given now. The poverty in Native American tribes, the lack of ability to prosecute criminal transgressions and so forth is absolutely horrific. It's not an either-or when it comes to slavery and when it comes to the genocide of the Native American people. But most of the reparative actions are in the form of legal action that is taken on behalf of the tribes and which I would certainly support.
I want to ask you very briefly, Ms. Williamson, I can't believe we only have about 4 minutes left. I apologize. But immigration, yesterday, Attorney General William Barr ordered immigration judges to stop allowing some asylum seekers to post bail while they wait for months or years for their cases to be heard. This is a system that the president has criticized as catch and release. What would your approach be?
Asylum is a right. Seeking asylum in America is a right. This is not something that historically we have denigrated. We have recognized that it is part of the moral authority and moral good of the United States, as inscribed by Emma Lazarus on the Statue of Liberty. The real crisis here is not what's happening at the border. The real crisis is what has happened in these people's lives to force them to seek asylum to begin with. And they should experience from the United States open arms. Are there legitimate questions, left versus right, at times yin and yang, complementary ideas on how we deal with these people? Yes, but there should be no argument on whether or not we do. Are there a tiny fraction of people seeking to come in at the border and elsewhere who are not good people, whether it has to do with MS-13 or anything else? Absolutely. Just like there's a fraction of people here already, and that's called law enforcement. But the idea of denigrating all people coming in at the border, particularly people seeking asylum, and saying that they're going to have to sit in American jails and waste away without the constitutional protections that we give to anyone else. Once you make it onto the ground of the United States of America, whether you're a citizen or not, there are certain constitutional protections that everyone here gets to have, saying that people cannot post bail. It is part of the ugly, ugly face of this administration.
So
it will stop when I'm president.
Check people out, and you've talked about the need for a criminal background check for people seeking asylum. Once somebody checks out, do you just let them go into the country and say, you know, see you back in 6 months, hope you come back for that hearing? Or how do you approach that? Because there's 103 people were apprehended at the southern border just in March alone. That's more than double the average monthly average.
We need more border agents. We need more technology. We need more judges. And that's where our money should be. Our money should be spent on the infrastructure that we need in order to be able to process all this in a humane way.
A couple more questions for you, Ms. Williamson. And we're almost out of time, so I do apologize again. But here's an email from Timothy in Warner who says, first of all, Marianne, I've enjoyed your amazingly well-written prayers, thoughts to God for years. Illuminata has been near my bed for years, Timothy says. How can you get your voice to influence the conversation of the 20 other candidates who have greater political connections than you have? Timothy, thank you so much for the email.
Well, first of all, the only reason you're writing me right now is because I'm on New Hampshire Public Radio. So I am. There is and has been a bit of a lockout, there's no doubt about it, from certain corners of the mainstream media. But I think that's starting to change. I had my CNN town hall the other night. I will be on Alex Witt this weekend. I will be on Stephanie Ruhle next week. I was on Morning Joe the other day. But this is a grassroots campaign. There is definitely a media and political establishment who do not find my campaign convenient. They don't find my candidacy convenient to their purposes. So what I say to the person who asked that question and to anyone else who's interested, you're going to have to make it happen. I hope you'll go to Marianne2020.com. I hope you'll give at least a dollar donation to help me get to those 65,000 votes. I need 14,000 more to be able to be on the DNC debate stage. And I need donations in order to wage a campaign that is equal in its power to have an effect as other candidates. I think the more people understand what's going on in this country, they see my candidacy as an example of how this system works. The aristocracy feels entitled, and they're going to control the conversation. And who are they to say, to make themselves the gatekeepers? Who are they to say who's a serious candidate? Who are they to say who's a long shot? That's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution says you have to be born here, 35, and lived here for 14 years. I think people are waking up. This is just an example of how this works. But I'm going to keep going, and I hope that people will continue to support me in keeping going, because that's not how America should work.
Well, Timothy, I appreciate the question, and I think he's right. We're almost at 20, not quite, but getting close in terms of Democratic presidential candidates.
Not just out to influence their conversation. Why don't they know what I'm doing this for? They're not doing it to influence mine. These are these subtle ways. They're not just influence. I'm not out to just elevate the conversation. I want to elevate America.
Well, and to his point, though, about this very crowded Democratic primary, how are you, Ms. Williamson, going to stand out in these interviews and in these debates from the other Democratic candidates? Why should people choose you versus any of the others?
I'm not saying why people should choose me. That's up to them. People should listen to the small, still voice within themselves. But I'm having an authentic and fierce conversation that I don't believe others are having. I'm talking about the millions of American children living in chronic trauma whose despair is simply normalized by our political establishment because of their lack of financial leverage. I'm talking about the deep corruption of our national security agenda. I'm talking about what's really going down with race relations in America. I'm sorry, but I haven't heard that from anyone else.
It's been really nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Marianne Williamson, again, best-selling author, well-known speaker. Her books include The Healing of America and her latest, A Politics of Love, a handbook for a new American revolution. I want to remind everyone that we have another presidential candidate on Friday, Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. He's a Republican, just announced his challenge against President Trump. You can email your questions for former Governor Weld at exchange@nhpr.org. And you can always go to nhpr.org for all of our coverage, to listen to past interviews, to find out what's coming up next. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.